Thank you very much, Harry. And I'd like to thank AusPayNet too for the invitation to speak at this session on the regulatory landscape. We thought it might be useful to start this session with a quick tour of some of the issues on the Reserve Bank's radar in our role as the primary regulator of the payment system. So I'll touch first on the significant change underway in the payments mix in Australia. As we in this room are all aware, the use of the analog payment system, payment methods, cash and cheques, is declining, while the use of electronic payments like cards and bank transfers is growing. If anything, these trends have accelerated in recent years, and the availability of the new payments platform will provide additional impetus to the migration towards electronic payments. As the Governor noted yesterday, the use of cash in transactions has been declining, but it is still used for a significant share of consumer purchases, and some groups of the population remain particularly reliant on it. In addition, there is still strong demand for Australian banknotes. So our journey towards a less cash or a near cashless payment system is much less progressed than the case of Sweden, which is the country people often talk about when contemplating a cashless economy. But as cash use falls, financial institutions may reduce the provision of cash services. There are already some signs of this in the ATM market, where bank and non-bank deployers have begun rationalising their fleets. Policy concerns could arise if there was a significant decline in ATM coverage that made it difficult for people to access cash, particularly in remote or regional locations. However, some sensible consolidation of the ATM network could result in a more efficient and sustainable ATM industry. One possibility is that this could come through some form of industry utility. I expect that we would have an open mind to an arrangement that resulted in a more sustainable ATM industry that continued to provide services where they are clearly still needed. In the case of cheques, the latest monthly data show a sharp fall in use relative to a year ago. There's been a fall of 23% in the number of cheques and a fall of 30% in the value of cheques. And those are falls over just 12 months. The number of household and business cheques written has been falling sharply for some time. But what is noteworthy in the recent data is a very significant fall in the number of financial institution or bank cheques. This reflects a rapid shift in the real estate industry towards electronic conveyancing. Looking at the recent data and considering the costs of maintaining the cheque system, we may be approaching the time that the industry might take a decision to announce the end of the cheque system. But as the Governor noted yesterday, it'll be important that the payment needs of remaining cheque users can be met via alternative instruments. As regards cards, most of you will be aware that the bank has been focusing on the cost of card payments to merchants. Indeed, I spoke about this issue at this conference last year. In particular, where a customer uses a dual network debit card in a contactless transaction, we've been pushing acquirers to provide merchants with the ability to send the authorisation message via the lower cost of the two networks. A range of stakeholders, including in Canberra, have also been calling for the industry to provide least cost routing. However, the response of the major banks has been disappointingly slow, as the Governor noted yesterday. This appears symptomatic of a broader lack of competition in acquiring services. In many respects, the card industry seems to be dominated by the issuing side of the market, with the incentive sometimes being to push higher cost over lower cost payment systems. However, least cost routing is coming, and several of the major banks now have pilots either underway or coming shortly. And for those merchants who would like access to least cost routing now, two acquirers, Tyro and First Data, are already in a position to enable it across their entire customer base. Let me touch now briefly on the new payments platform. While the rollout of the NPP has been somewhat slower than initially expected, transaction volumes have been growing steadily. The Payment System Board discussed the NPP last Friday. it stressed the importance of the major banks continuing to work on their internal projects so that their customers will be able to take full advantage of this important new infrastructure. You may also be aware that the bank, with the assistance from the ACCC, is undertaking a consultation on NPP functionality and access. The NPP provides a number of ways for entities to access the central infrastructure. However, there have been some concerns that the services offered through the NPP and the ways of accessing it are not yet meeting the needs of all entities. The bank is keen for the NPP to be a platform for innovation, including from new entrants. So submissions to our consultation are due this Friday. We hope we'll receive submissions from a wide range of entities, but especially from fintechs and other newer players. More details on the consultation are available on our website. And if this is the first you've heard of the consultation and can only make a submission after the deadline, please get in touch with us. Finally, I should note that the bank is participating in the Council of Financial Regulators' review of the regulatory framework for stored value facilities. The review is aiming to simplify and clarify the regulatory regime for these facilities, ensuring that regulation appropriately protects customers while minimising barriers to innovation and competition. Earlier this month, as part of the review, the council agencies hosted an industry roundtable, which was very useful. And I would expect that the council will provide an update on the conclusions of the review in the first half of 2019. So that's an overview of some of the payments issues that the Reserve Bank has been focusing on recently. And I'd be happy to provide some further perspectives in the remainder of this session. Thank you.
All right, now I'd like to call the panelists and Nancy Brilla, General Counsel of the Australian Payments Network, will moderate and introduce the panel.
Thank you. So thank you very much, Tony. That was a very insightful introduction. And there are so many points coming out of your remarks that I'd really like to explore on the panel today. So it's actually a perfect segue into our discussion on regulatory reforms. Joining us today, we have Melisande, who is the General Manager of Licensing at APRA. She's responsible, she's also the FinTech lead at APRA. And we have Stephen King, who's a commissioner with the Productivity Commission. Stephen was actually part of the team that wrote the report around competition into financial services. So drawing from your report, one of the overarching themes was actually around the regulators and the fact that they had focused on stability, perhaps at the expense of competition. And APRA earlier this year actually introduced a new framework, which was actually aimed at initiating competition and trying to strike a bit of balance between competition and stability. And that was the restricted ADI framework. So I'm going to start by asking Melisande about that framework, and particularly, whilst I know it's still early days, can you tell us about whether it has successfully met its objectives or is likely to successfully meet those objectives?
Thanks, Nancy. So as Nancy said, we released a restricted ADI framework in May this year, and we, at the day after, licensed the first restricted ADI. Since that time, we have been engaging with a large number of other applicants, both for restricted ADI licenses, but also for a broader range of ADI licenses as well. So while I would say the restricted ADI framework has provided this additional path, and in that sense, I think it has been successful in flushing out some new people to come and talk to us, I also think it's actually opened people's eyes to the fact that it is available to become like a bank either through the restricted path or more broadly. The actual framework has also been supported by the fact that APRA centralised its licensing function in the last year, and having one central team who's dealing with all the new applicants who is dealing with all the issues has really helped.
So just picking up on your point, so you've had a few new applicants for mm-hmm. ADI licences. So we're likely to see some new ADIs entering the markets, so neobanks. And so I guess my next question to the panel is, do you see these new ADIs actually having an effect on competition in our market? Will they innovate? Will they challenge the big four? What are your perspectives on that?
Well, OK, thanks, Nancy. Perhaps if I can start on that. It's really good to see a new pathway or an improved pathway for innovative companies to be able to become ADIs, restricted ADIs, then potentially become full ADIs. But the problem in Australia isn't a lack of ADIs. We've got ADIs coming out our ears. Many of those ADIs are working with innovative startups. There are issues of legacy systems in some of those ADIs, but in reality, the big four are not going to be challenged by those ADIs. The big four will gobble up, quite frankly, anything that becomes innovative. We've seen it in other industries. Just to give you the perspective here, if you take Macquarie and every other ADI and add them up by the value of their assets, for example, their balance sheets, assets, you only get to the size of a Westpac or a CBA. So put them all together and you might have a challenger for one of the big four. And that's not going to happen. So this is competition. It's really important competition, but it is round the edge. Don't expect a revolution.
So I think one thing I would say, which is potentially different to that, is that would rely on the big banks not innovating themselves. Because one of the things that we are seeing with these new entrants, the new neobanks, some of the other models that are starting up in this space, such as Up, who will be speaking to you afterwards, is actually a completely different mindset and a different sort of approach to providing a service that I think is going to be, it's not impossible, but it's difficult for the major banks to replicate sometimes because of their legacy systems and the frameworks they've got. So therefore, I think the actual competition that is starting, as you say, it's not just about numbers. Mm-hmm. It's actually that there is going to be a different service on offer.
Would you like to add to that?
Yeah, I think I'd agree with Melisande in a few respects. And the governor commented yesterday that the bank had been disappointed with the progress that some of the major banks had been rolling out functionality in the NPP and at least cost routing. I think to a significant extent, that reflects the complexity of some of their systems. There are some of the stories we hear about the difficulty that banks have got in modernising their systems are almost hair-raising. So to the extent that the challenger banks are all using incredibly new platforms, can be much more agile, I hope that you can see more competition than just at the edge.
I just said one extra final thing as well. If you look at some of the international players, some of the fintechs have got very big, very fast, if they have managed to nail the offering that they're doing.
Yeah, the big advances, though, when you're looking particularly at payments, are in those countries that are underbanked. So if you start, you know, Alipay is the obvious example where people say, well, look at what Alipay has done. Look at that sort of innovation. That was in a country with a highly regulated banking system where, quite frankly, people didn't put their money into banks. It was a massively underbanked society. You look at M-Pesa in Kenya, same driving forces. In Australia, we're in the very fortunate situation that we're well and truly not underbanked, and we've actually, particularly in the payment space, seen the sort of innovations that makes it hard for that leapfrog that in some ways you need for innovation to really displace current competition. Are we going to see an Alipay sort of disruption here? I don't think so, because we already have the disruption when people pull out their MasterCard, Visa, or EFTPOS card and go tap and pay and go. And that's the sort of innovation we've seen. That's driving feed-for-flight production in cash in this country. It's exactly the same as what happened in Sweden. Everyone talks about Swish as the new entrant. Swish is tiny in Sweden. The reduction in cash is all driven by traditional debit card. It's not driven by the new payment instrument. That's at best marginal in Sweden.
So I think Alipay is really interesting because on a transaction basis, it certainly had a lot more transactions than the largest card scheme in China, being UnionPay. And so do the other panellists think that we'll similarly see some kind of disruption from a similar type of stored value facility or digital wallet here in Australia?
Well, I'd agree with the point Stephen made a little while ago about the fact that the markets where you've had these huge growth of disruptors have been ones where the banks haven't been providing particularly good services, where they've been underbanked. So China, Kenya are examples of that. And in Australia, we're fortunate that we've got a very highly banked population. But on this question of stored value facilities and Alipay type things, it's interesting that 20 years ago, people thought that there was going to be growth in this area. And we put a regulatory framework in place that envisaged that there'd be lots of these purchase payment facilities or stored value facilities, and it hasn't really happened. You know, 20 years ago, they thought there'd be things like Mondex, et cetera, would all be carrying around electronic purses that would replace cash, and it wouldn't be bank account to a bank account payments, but that hasn't happened. But one of the interesting things happening at the moment is that the Council of Financial Regulators has got a consultation going on these stored value facilities, and maybe something Melissa might want to talk about.
Yeah, so I think the only current PPF that we have is PayPal, and so it is fair to people to say that there's not been much competition in this space, but I actually think that some of this is actually driven by technology, and we're starting to see a lot more interest. There's a lot more people coming and speaking to us. But also, if you look at the other markets and so forth, Singapore is highly banked. And I was there for the FinTech Festival a week and a half ago, and there were 150 digital wallets. I couldn't even tell you how many there were or what they were all doing, but they've still taken off in that type of market. So it would be interesting to see what actually happens here. Maybe it will be more niche services, but I don't think you can rule out that just because we're currently banked that something couldn't take off. And the type of things that we're seeing now hitting this PPF framework are not actually the same as I think what was originally envisaged by, or maybe the digital wallet thing has really only just recently been something that can actually be done in some fashion. So In my world, it's actually quite interesting because there's quite a lot of competition I see between the neobanks, which are going to be just an app, and the digital wallets, which are also just an app, but they're both under a different framework. Mm. So trying to get the right balance in this PPF framework is actually going to be really important, not just for the digital wallets, but also for the neobanks.
So there absolutely has been a massive growth in digital wallets in overseas jurisdictions, and I know that the review is currently underway, but is there any real impediments that you can see at the moment that will stop the growth of digital wallets in Australia?
I think one thing which is very clear is there's no international standard for this type of space. So if you look at a lot of countries and jurisdictions have actually just been reviewing this area and they've changed their framework, but they haven't sort of coalesced around one type of framework. And that's actually challenging for us because typically it's better not just for us, but for players as well, if you can have some sort of international consistency. Within Australia, we have challenges in terminology, which makes it very difficult to engage with people because you're not speaking the same language. And I think the actual framework is just old. It was designed in 2006. We didn't have the actual examples in front of us. We now have examples in front of us under lots of different business models, and that's actually the ideal time to review the framework because you're not just reviewing it with one business model in mind. You're trying to get a framework that actually applies to a large number of business models and will help to get the right balance. I think there's lots of good innovation. You want to encourage that innovation and get it out there in the market, but you also want to make sure that it's fair and that it's safe. I probably do need to make a plug for safety, given the previous comments. I do think safety is important, both for digital wallets and also for the neobanks and the new ADI entrants. While we're trying to help facilitate new entrants come in and understand the framework and work through our requirements and so forth, if we have a failure, particularly in these early stages, that's actually going to impact all the new entrants and have a detrimental impact on competition. Ultimately, over time, I think it would be healthy if there was a few failures with some of the new entrants, but for these first few, I think it would be damaging.
Well, yeah, I'd do a different take on that, okay. Which won't surprise you, Melissa. I agree entirely that we've got a very, an out-of-date framework, I think I'd call it, for the digital wallets, for the PPFs, and that being updated, that's fantastic. I would suggest, though, that an emphasis on let's not make sure anyone fails is likely to strangle the innovation at birth. It will be a cost that outweighs the benefit.
I'm not saying it's an emphasis. It's important.
So we need to make sure, though, that the sort of constraints that we put on the digital wallets in terms of the prudential requirements that we put on them, if we decide that there are prudential requirements, and we may decide, look, for ones that hold less than an individual can't hold more than $1,000 in an account, we may say, actually, that's fine. That's going to be outside the standard prudential framework. So we could go down that sort of route. Because the more you put the prudential regulation on the PPFs and the digital wallet at the beginning, the more you're going to constrain the sort of innovation that can occur. And that necessarily occurs when you put regulation on, you're putting a framework that will direct the innovation. Now, I'm not saying we want to go down the Alipay route, and I mean, as you'd be aware, Alipay is also the biggest money market that holds the deposits in money market accounts. It was actually outside the prudential regulatory net in China, I think until about 6 months ago, when suddenly the Chinese central bank said, well, hang on, you guys had better come into the net because there's a significant stability risk here. So we don't want to go down that far. We've got to be somewhere in between, but I would caution, let's not strangle the innovation at birth.
I think we're actually in furious agreement, because what we're finding at the moment is we're capturing too many people in some senses, okay. And that's making it harder. And so one of the things we're trying to look at is the thresholds for how can you actually make sure that you're allowed to operate outside of the prudential framework as long as it's out in within these bounds, and then capture the right parts in there. And that's really the crux of what we're trying to work out at the moment, what should be in. Yep. And actually, we don't want huge numbers in. We'd love there to be things that can happen outside of our environment, because it's annoying for us and for them.
And let's be clear that there will still be forms of regulation on the smaller entities.
Yeah.
But it'll be ASIC-based stuff.
Yeah.
It'll be things like fit and proper tests, restrictions on what can be done with client monies, things like that. So
Yes, you don't want Ponzi schemes.
Yeah. And that aligns with the governor's speech yesterday, where he talked about the shift to electronic payments and the greater importance of actually ensuring that there is safety and reliability built in. Tony, you mentioned your current collaboration with the ACCC on MPP access and functionality. I know that's still underway, but I just thought I'd ask the question because I know lots of audience members have also asked me this question. In terms of access to MPP, we know that the shareholders have invested so much money into this, and so is it too early to even be talking about access? Should we not just be waiting to see how things play out in terms of competition? Any thoughts on that?
We are hearing from some smaller entities, some newer entities, that that they think that there are access issues to be dealt with. We're not starting with the presumption that there is, but we want to better understand the issue. It may be that what the entities that are complaining about really want is just better services from their banks. So for initially, the major banks have been fairly slow to roll out NPP functionality that take full advantage of the richer data, the easier addressing, etc., through the NPP. So it may be that's the major thing. It's a problem with NPP functionality rather than access. But you did refer to the fact that the existing shareholders have invested a lot in the NPP, and I think there is some precedent for new systems to have rule outside of the payment system, for new systems to have rules that new entrants are required to become shareholders, because you've got you want to encourage people to sign up to fund the build of the new system, and if you tell people that you don't have to pay a subscription fee, you can join on day two and not pay anything, then you won't get anyone to sign up and fund the build on day one. And Stephen might be able to tell us more about what happens in other industries, but we will have to look at a number of issues, but we certainly do acknowledge the fact that the industry spent a lot of money building this thing, and one of the reasons they did it was because they knew that they couldn't avoid the subscription fee by waiting to sign up to join on day two.
I know you've got some comments on that topic as well, Stephen.
Yeah, so let me start on the equity investment, and it is done in other areas. I'm involved in the airports review that the Productivity Commission is doing at the moment, and jet fuel facilities go through a common facility at airports, which is owned by the fuel companies, and to get access, for example, here in Sydney, you need to buy an equity share in that. As you'll see when our draft report comes out, we don't think that works very well, and for the same reasons that I think we have concerns about the NPP, and that is that you've got a structure where the parties that will be most damaged by successful competition are the exact same parties who own the facility and will set the terms and conditions for the equity investment. And even if the price is made transparent, experience in other utility industries shows that it's very hard for parties that really will be innovators and disruptors to get in, even when the rules appear clear, because they've still got to get past the exact same people that they will be disrupting. And I think telecommunications in Australia showed us, well, at least 25 years worth of failed disruption, because the structure of the network, of the bottleneck part, had never been properly resolved in this country until we tried to roll out the NBN, and we all know where we are. Not a great model to go down. And that's the Productivity Commission's fear with the NPP. We see parties, even though it's early days, and it's very easy to say, look, you know, the parties that want access now, rules are still being made, terms and conditions are still being constructed. They can get access, they can go through Cuscal and get access. There's information issues about what, if you're an overlay service provider, what information can you get about customers using your own overlay service from a financial institution. That's not clear at the moment. It's not clear that you can get the information you'll value. It's not clear exactly, even if you got access to the MPP, what other things innovators need around it. So, for example, an exchange settlement account at the RBA, you know, having access, direct access and exchange settlement account may be what you need to actually be a real innovator in this space. There's all of these things, and they're questions we can't answer today. But we do know from experience that when you have the parties that will be most hurt by the disruption owning that bottleneck, then you're unlikely to get those questions resolved in a way that promotes competition without some form of regulatory intervention. Maybe light-handed, maybe an access regime, but there's got to be a regulator in there cracking the whip.
I think that's a huge topic, and I'm sure we can discuss it to so much longer. I'm going to actually go to one of the audience members on the screen around interchange fees, which looks to be a very popular question. And this is something that the governor touched on in his speech yesterday, and Tony, you also mentioned the cost to merchants in your remarks in your introduction today. I might just add to that, what are some of the lessons that we can take from overseas experience in terms of looking at interchange in our market? So who wants to start with that?
We've got the PC called for interchange fee, etc. So I'm happy to start with that. Australia's led the world on interchange fee regulation. I mean, the Reserve Bank from, I think it was 2006, was effectively the first country in the world to go down this track. We've been followed internationally. So when you say, can we learn from overseas, the Reserve Bank are leading the world in this. The Payment System Board is leading the world in this. At the same time, we have seen a game of regulatory whack-a-mole in interchange fees, which is because the RBA and the Payment System Board have quite correctly followed a standard regulatory model of attempting to say, let's try and work out what the relevant costs are and set an interchange fee to reflect those costs. Perfectly sensible. We see it in other regulated industries. However, payments are different. They're not like other regulated industries. They are a two-sided platform. And when the Reserve Bank, and you're dealing with three-party and four-party card networks, so three-party do not have an interchange fee as such. So what's happened is every time the Reserve Bank set its interchange fee regulation, there's been loopholes that parties have happily jumped through. And if you're like me and have just had your American Express companion card wiped out by the bank, my wife's very upset because we no longer get rewarded through numerous Qantas frequent flyer points for using that card. Of course, some merchants pay a lot more. You know, the reward points don't come from nowhere. It comes out of the price everyone pays if a merchant doesn't surcharge. So our view is we need to simplify the interchange fee regulation, and zero is a very simple, easy simplification. There is no good case in mature card systems to have a positive interchange fee. We've seen situations such as FPOS in its earlier days where the interchange fee went the other way. So the idea that we have to have an interchange fee because otherwise Visa and MasterCard will collapse is complete nonsense in my view. What I do think we need to do, though, is to make sure that by focusing on the interchange fee, we're actually focusing on the right place in a world where we have three-party card schemes. So our recommendations were zero interchange fee and that the ACCC investigate the broader payment system, both merchant service fees, interchange fees, and the relationship back to consumer rewards, and work out, are we actually looking in the right place? Have we got the right approach and focus to regulatory structure? Or should we actually be looking somewhere else? For example, should we be looking at merchant service fees? And is that a better place to regulate? But whilst we've got interchange regulation, zero is the right answer.
Any response from you, Tony?
Who's been to the United States recently? They've got high interchange fees, so they should have a very, very innovative payment system. Or, you know, so last time you went there, you probably tried to tap your card and couldn't do that. So you probably tried to do a PIN, couldn't do that either. You ended up signing. So I don't think there's any evidence that you need high interchange fees to have an innovative card system. And in Australia, for example, we lead the world in contactless adoption. And so I think you can have a dynamic, innovative, flexible card system with low interchange fees. So as Stephen said, the Reserve Bank led the way here, and we're very comfortable with what we've done. And we think that that the bank's actions over the past 15 years have resulted in a more competitive and efficient payment system. Does that mean we should go further and lower them even further? In medicine, I think there's probably the case that some, doses of medicine are very good for patients up to a certain level, but that doesn't mean that giving the patient even more of the medicine is necessarily going to be even better for the patient, and it may be the case on interchange fees. So we will be reviewing the... we do reviews of the card payments regulation system periodically, and we will certainly look at the arguments for a further reduction in the caps when we do that. But it would be taking a holistic view of the regulatory system, looking at the surcharging rules, looking at both the three-party and the four-party systems. And I think it's too early to foreshadow what we might find there. But at the moment, I think we're pretty comfortable with the way that the regulatory framework is working. But we appreciate that the Productivity Commission's done a thorough piece of work and has given us some recommendations to look at.
So we're very quickly running out of time, so I might just ask the audience if anyone has any questions, because I know that not everyone has access to the app to be able to send their questions through there. We have one question here. Is there a roving mic that we can...
Hi. I think the question is also up on the screen too. I was going to inquire about, it's sort of related to the interchange aspect too and Apple Pay. What are your thoughts about QR codes as a mode of payments that have significantly taken off across the Asian market or more so the developing markets? And as you can see, there's a big dilemma with Apple Pay and the majors. And it revolves around interchange mainly. So I guess what are your thoughts about QR or other mode of payments other than the traditional NFC?
I can start on that. Well, QR codes is really just a way of transmitting information. But the way that QR codes have been used in China, for example, is to facilitate transactions between within wallets like Alipay, etc. In principle, there's no reason why QR codes couldn't initiate account-to-account transactions. So at some point in the future, potentially QR codes could be used in the NPP to in some point of sale type environments. I can easily imagine that at a market on a Saturday morning, a small grower's market or something like that, a small merchant might say, I'd like you to make an account-to-account payment rather than a card payment. And that account-to-account payment might be because they might do that by giving the customer their pay ID and asking the customer to make a payment. Or they might, maybe there'll be a QR code type arrangement to facilitate that. So we could certainly have QR codes, but it might be to initiate card payments, it might be to initiate bank account to a bank account transactions, or potentially it might be wallet transactions, who knows.
Oh, my only addition, I think you're dead right. I think that there will be an app available, a service provider using the MPP will make a situation where QR codes can be used for those direct transfers. However, again, from what we've seen overseas from countries that are ahead of us, so if I was Square and I made my business out of the markets with people putting in little card readers into my mobile phones, I'd be worried. If I was Visa and MasterCard, would I be worried? No, because in this country we've got the situation where you go up, tap, pay. It's already very convenient. And you know, even in countries where it's not as convenient as the card systems in Australia, you haven't seen those QR code MPP type processes taken off, because we already have a widely adopted, easy to use payment system. That's why I tend to focus so much on things like the interchange fee, because I see our payment system going more and more electronic, less cash, but more focused on Visa, MasterCard, FPOS. And that really worries me, because those three networks will be controlling the cost of our payments network. And I think we need to think hard about that.
So So I might just turn to another question from the board around open banking. So we've had a few sessions on open banking over the last couple of days, but I'm very interested in whether, from a regulatory perspective, the reforms that are being put in place, do you have any perspectives around whether that is actually going to increase competition?
So I'm happy to. All right. I'll be very quick then. To a degree, yes. Again, we've seen open banking reforms overseas. The UK is an obvious example. The first thing that happens is all the information gets used, and you have a nice app on your phone where you can just look at all your bank accounts and all your other investments at once, and that's very nice and so on, not revolutionary. We haven't seen revolutions coming out of open banking. We've again seen competition around the margins. So I think one of the things we need to think of is how can we make sure that parties who want to use the information or the access to information, customer information created by open banking, they want to use that for innovation. How do we make sure that there aren't other barriers to them innovating and being able to benefit customers in the way that we want? So open banking I look on as one element, but there are other elements such as MPP access, such as thinking about exchange settlement accounts and so on. And I think it's thinking of all of those elements together. That's where the innovation will come from.
I would have to agree. I mean, from our conversations with entities, open banking can't hurt. But a lot of these other issues crop up as things that are very important.
Okay, thank you. So with only half a minute left, do any of you have any final remarks or comments that you'd love to leave the audience with?
I think what I'd like to say, from APRA's perspective, we're open to all variety of different business models, whether they come with QR codes, whether they come as a digital wallet that needs our sort of regulation or what have you. As long as people can meet our standards, we can help people get through. So some of the questions that were on the screen were, would we accept this type of bank, or would we sort of accept, you know, like a WeChat bank or something coming to Australia? Well, we would if they met our standards. We don't have a particular business model that we're trying to push.
Any closing comments, Tony?
Just an observation that we deal with a lot of you, a lot, mm-hmm. and particularly those of you who are in the larger financial institutions know you can come to the Reserve Bank and talk to us when you've got issues regarding the payment systems. But I'd encourage those of you who are in newer entities, fintechs, etc., that we've got an open door and always happy to hear about your issues. Thank you.
Stephen.
And I guess I'd just repeat, we're setting up all the elements for some real innovation and potential competition. I'm the damp squib. I think it's going to be around the edge, but it's still going to be exciting. And it's going to mean that in 10 years' time, we're going to be in a lot better place in terms of payments than we are now. But we've got to be able to get it right. And the regulators, the RBA and APRA, are going to have a key role in this.
I've greatly enjoyed this discussion, and I hope you have as well. Please join me in thanking our wonderful panelists.